Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. I'm Alan Saunders. This week, the second half of my conversation from this year's Sydney Writers' Festival with John Gray, Emeritus Professor of European Thought at the London School of Economics. Last week, we talked mostly about Gray's book Straw Dogs and its vision, drawn from the political philosopher Isaiah Berlin, of agonistic liberalism. That's to say, a liberalism that acknowledges the need to deal with a world in which there are universal human values, goods that are good for nearly all human beings and bads that are bad for nearly all human beings, but that they conflict with each other. We can't have everything. We often have to choose between goods, we often have to choose between evils, and we choose between goods and evils, and this goes on all the time. But how does the modern world look when viewed from this perspective? Hallelujah, for the Lord God omnipotent reigneth. The kingdom of this world is become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign for ever and ever. A distinctly religious vision of a world transformed. But what has this to do with the secular world today and the war in Iraq? Here's John Gray in conversation with me at the Sydney Writers' Festival. Some of these ideas continue, or I was going to say some of them continue to animate, but they actually sort of form the armature of your new book, Black Mass. Now, you begin in Black Mass by talking about utopianism and millenarianism. When I came to the book, I immediately thought, no, that can't be right, until I'd read your argument, because I think of millenarianism as being about a divine eruption, as it were, into human history, and I think of utopianism as being something that we human beings are supposed to realize by ourselves. Yeah. But you draw a very clear connection between these two modes of thought.
Yes, I do, and that's a very clear summary of a large part of the argument of the book. The type of utopianism we have today, and we had in the 20th century, in which we probably had at least since the French Revolution, since the Jacobins, differs from the utopianism of other cultures and other times. I mean, utopian ideas, ideas of a much better society, or even of an almost perfect society, are found pretty well everywhere. They're found in Plato. But they're normally situated in the lost past, not in the future. Or they're situated, you can find right up into the 18th century in English writing, in Samuel Johnson, for example, you can find, as it were, utopian stories. They're situated in places in the world which are off the map. They might be in the present, but they're places which are off the map and which it's assumed don't exist. What was new in the late 18th century was the idea that a society may not be perfect, but better than any that had hitherto existed, could be created by human effort, human will. And I interpret that. And here again, I stand on the shoulders of other thinkers, not just a great thinker like Berlin, but another one whom I also knew personally, recently died, at the age of 92, Norman Cohn, who wrote a book called The Pursuit of the Millennium, which is about medieval millenarianism, these great movements that swept over Europe throughout the medieval period, because contrary to some nostalgic conservatives who look back to the medieval period as a period of great peace, organic society, absolutely wonderful, it was a period of perpetual warfare and mass slaughter, much of it animated by religious dissension. And these millenarian movements were movements which expected, as the word millenarian suggests, that Jesus would come back to the world and rule for 1,000 years. There would be a tremendous battle, a cataclysmic struggle, and after that struggle, there would be a perfect or much better society. And in one or two places, millenarian movements seized power. They seized power in a German city for a few years and set up a kind of theocratic communist utopia in which you had to leave all your windows open, all private possessions, gold and so forth, was confiscated, and women had to marry anyone who asked them. And if they didn't, they were executed. and some were executed. Pretty ghastly society, if you ask me. It then was surrounded by the church, the Catholic Church, who was opposed to this. It was defeated, and the leader of it was tortured and actually then executed. But they were religious movements, as you say, Alan, because God was coming in to do the transformation. But from the Jacobins onwards, you get the idea that humans can do this by themselves, using often rather terrible means, because in the millenarian way of thinking, the best society, the good society, is preceded by terrible catastrophes, terrible conflicts, terrible cataclysms. And this was sort of carried on into secular thought. The Jacobins thought that terror could be pedagogic. People could be taught through being terrorized. And Lenin, who criticized the Jacobins and later on the French communards on the ground that they were too weak-kneed, they weren't consistent enough, they didn't kill enough people, also thought this. He thought terror was absolutely essential. That the first provisional government in post-Tsarist Russia abolished capital punishment. It was Lenin who brought it back in the famous hanging order, which he sent out to the provincial Soviets, which said, bring it back in, shoot peasants, and make sure it's in public and the other peasants see it. And this was in order to facilitate requisition of grain from the peasants. Now, that was a sort of a practical device, if you like. He needed the grain, and there was a civil war going on as well. But the idea that terror can be used as part of an armory of human instruments to produce an incomparably better society has been adopted not just by Lenin, but by Mao, and a whole variety of 20th century totalitarian dictators. What it always produces is an immense loss of life and incalculable numbers of broken lives, lives which don't end but are broken beyond repair by imprisonment, ill health, separation of loved ones, and so on and so forth. It never produces the results that it's intended to produce. The old slogan, you can't have an omelette without breaking eggs, misses out the fact that you can break millions of eggs and still not have a single omelette. And that's, in a way, the history of the 20th century, and I'm sort of adamantly and categorically opposed to that kind of revolutionary utopia. But I take it as also, though, as a secular translation of certain traditions. There are other traditions within Christianity which, of course, are opposed to this. The traditions of St. Augustine, of course, right from the start, in a way, almost the start, tried to defeat these apocalyptic trends in, or neutralize them in Christianity. But it's a secular continuation. The faith-based wars of the modern world, in which I include Iraq, although Iraq was also an oil grab, the faith-based wars, the wars in which are launched at least partly in order to convert a part of the world to our way of life, our way of seeing things, which is supposedly, and in some cases genuinely really is much better. I don't think anybody who hasn't lost their senses or their nerve could deny that a liberal society such as Australia or Britain or America is much, much, much better than that which was imposed on the Afghans by the Taliban. And you have to be demented to really think that. But it's a different thing to recognize that, as I do, and nonetheless think that war can be used as a sort of instrument of conversion. And the result is always the same. It's why I opposed the Iraq war from about a year before the launching of the war. When I became convinced it was going to be launched, I started opposing it, because the use of large-scale violence for these purposes, to transform the world, always has these terrible results. They're almost always the opposite of what were originally intended.
The people who one can blame for the Iraq war, I suppose, are the American neoconservatives. You've written in Black Mass that apocalyptic thinking moved to the centre of American politics after 9/11. This is a clear movement of thought which you can detect earlier. And one of the aspects of Black Mass which most interested me was you talk about what's happened to conservatism. And what's happened to conservatism is just really rather strange, isn't it? Tell us about that, in Britain and to some extent in Australia as well, and in America.
Strange and comic in certain ways. I mean, I remember being because I was a Thatcherite at one time, I don't repent that. But I never held to these batty ideas. I mean, the way to achieve a certain kind of reputation in these circles of the intellectual right then was to advance ever more absurd proposals. It was called thinking of the unthinkable. Do you have that phrase over here? What basically that means is take the current conventional wisdom and develop it to the point of absurdity. That's what thinking the unthinkable means. So if you said, well, it's not enough to privatise housing, there are large parts of the British Navy that should be privatised. You say, but he's a young up-and-coming thinker. Watch him. Very shrewd. Shrewd. And there was a certain kind of batty rationalism about on the right, by which I mean applying ideas, applying policies out of their original contexts, just applying a kind of principle and expecting it to work. It's not the way things do work. And one of the good features of sort of old-fashioned conservatism, I don't call myself a conservative anymore, although I do think I still hold to aspects of a conservative view of the world, because there isn't such a thing as conservatism anymore, as a project or as an intellectual outlook. It's really been lost, partly as a sort of side effect, a byproduct, if you like, of the political success. The political success of the new right was great, not just of Thatcher and Reagan, but I mean the political success of it basically demolished, along with the collapse of the Soviet Union, demolished the left, which then embraced aspects of new conservative thinking. Blair was an American neoconservative in Downing Street, for example, and pretty well all the parties, and I think this is true here as well, have sort of coalesced on a kind of neoconservative or neoliberal worldview. My view always was and still is, but it's a view now that doesn't fit into any part of the political spectrum, that of the great British painter Francis Bacon, some of you may know about, the greatest 20th century painter. When he was asked how he votes, he said, oh, I always vote to the right. He was a very radical type, he said to her. So why is that, Mr. Bacon? He said, oh, they make the best of a jolly bad job. Now, that kind of sort of right wing doesn't exist anymore. Utopianism has migrated from the left, where it was for most of the 20th century in most parts of the world, to the right. And in America, it was one of the factors. I wouldn't say it was only the neocons who are to be held account for the Iraq War. Quite a lot of American liberals, liberal interventionists, also supported it, and the same was true in Britain.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Philosopher's Zone, and this is John Gray in conversation with me at the Sydney Writers' Festival. Now, those liberal interventionists have their own history, and one of its key figures is Woodrow Wilson, 28th President of the United States, who after World War I helped create the League of Nations and shape the Treaty of Versailles with special attention to creating new nations out of defunct empires, for which he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1919.
Just after the First World War, Woodrow Wilson thought that the Habsburg Empire, which was by then, of course, very weakened, would have collapsed probably anyway, but he thought the Habsburg Empire, which I view as one of the great civilizing institutions of Europe, compared with what came later, mass murder on a huge scale. If you belong to some minority in Eastern or Central Europe, you're a damn sight better off under the Habsburgs than you were under Hitler or the tin pot dictators who he created. I think it was a civilising enterprise. But
Can I just say there that there's a very good biography of the philosopher Karl Popper by Malachi Hacohen, and Hacohen makes the point that in the last years of the Habsburg Empire, its loyalist supporters were the Jews, because everybody else either was or potentially was an ethnic nationalist.
Yes.
And the Jews were the only people who knew that whoever gained by the downfall of the Habsburg Empire, it wouldn't be them.
Absolutely.
They were going to be in deep trouble. They didn't realise how much trouble they were going to be in. But
they probably had some inkling of it.
Yes,
though.
Yes.
And
yes.
So, I mean, I don't say it could have been hung on to. It was destroyed like the Ottoman Empire, all Europe, the Romanovs, not so attractive empires, they were all destroyed, and the British Empire too, eventually, by the First World War. So I don't think it can be hung on to. But the Wilsonian enterprise was really one which said, we've got to create these nation-states, self-governing nation-states, democratic nation-states in Central and Eastern Europe, because that's the way human beings should live. Now, the problem about that in Central and Eastern Europe was, what it produced was not the sort of liberal, nationalist republics that Wilson imagined. Because there was a tremendous amount of sheer ethnic hatred in Eastern and Central Europe. It produced, in one or two cases, Pilsudski might be an exception in Poland, but it produced murder, it produced the persecution of internal and external minorities. And in a very simple way, I'm glad you mentioned this, Alan, because in fact I see the Iraq adventure on its idealist side, because it did have an idealist side. It wasn't just an oil grab, contrary to what some people on the left say. What it did was it emancipated the Iraq adventure, the political forces which had been bottled up by Saddam's tyranny, and those were predominantly fundamentalist forces. I mean, after all, if you were a member of a religious minority, a Christian or a Yazidi or a Mandean or the handful of Jews who were left in Baghdad under Saddam, would you now be more or less frightened? Would you now be more or less afraid of your life or your liberty being lost? If you were a woman in Saddam's admittedly hideous tyranny, would you be more or less free, have more or less opportunities now than then in this period of Islamist tyranny? It would be emancipated that in the way that Wilson, without meaning to, of course, without understanding what he was doing, assisted the emancipation, which might have happened anyway after the First World War, but it assisted and perhaps aggravated the emancipation of ethnic nationalism. Just as Wilson empowered ethnic nationalism in Central and Eastern Europe, so the neocon Wilsonians and the liberal interventionists who agreed with them on this have empowered radical Islam in Iraq. There is democracy in Iraq. I'm talking about the non-Kurdish part of Iraq, because the Kurdish zone is a peaceful, well-ordered, separate state, because there is no state of Iraq anymore. But in the rest of Iraq, there is a type of democracy, but it's a chaotic version of the type of democracy that exists in Iran. So it has sort of opposite results. But you're right to say than the ones intended. I mean, if you read the journalism I wrote in the year running up to the war, I sort of became an Iraq obsessive, I'm afraid, at the time, because I could see this disaster getting closer and closer. The war would occur, that it would be an initial military success for the first 5 or 6 weeks, and you would have an unending guerrilla war, and what would come out of it would be, of course, an enormous amount of human suffering and sorrow and loss of life and refugees and so forth, but most likely the breakup of the Iraq state and the triumph of some kind of Islamic fundamentalism. And I think here, you see, it's the refusal to admit that in some parts of the world, tyranny, though terrible, may be less terrible than a situation in which the tyrant is toppled. It's an unwillingness to admit that extremely unpleasant reality, which partly sort of lies behind this adventure. The idea was, if you get rid of the tyrant, you'll have freedom. Hardly ever happens. If you get rid of the tyrant, you very often have anarchy. And anarchy can be actually worse than tyranny. There have been tyrannies that are worse than anarchy. Hitler's was. Pol Pot's was. Stalin's was. But there are quite a lot of situations in which anarchy is even worse than tyranny. And the sort of mixture of anarchy and theocracy, which is what you have in Iraq now, is, I think, one of the most potent evils in the world. And now that we've got it there, it's going to be jolly difficult to do anything about it. You're going to reconquer it. You're going to scour the world for another Saddam. You often find this now. People say, what we need is a really tough secular dictator. Thought we had one 6 years ago. I thought that was what we went in to get rid of. But actually it couldn't happen, because the Saddam, even if you could find someone sufficiently brutal and sadistic and so forth and secular to do it, the machine's gone. You've let the genie out of the bottle. So it's going to all go on for decades or even generations. And that wasn't necessary, it wasn't inevitable. And there needn't have been an invasion of Iraq. It needn't have occurred. It wouldn't have occurred if there hadn't been 9/11 or if there'd been someone wiser in the White House. I'm even inclined to say, some of you may think this is implausible, I think it's actually quite plausible, if George Bush Sr. had still been there, it might well not have happened. Because he'd have turned around, he fought in the Second World War, he knew action. He turned around and said, well, I don't know, you know, do we really know what's going to come out of all this? Maybe we should hang on, maybe we shouldn't do it.
Well, he was the man who didn't take his army to Baghdad when he
exactly.
had the chance.
Exactly.
We're coming towards an end now, but there is something that occurred to me while you were speaking, which is that if I were a member of the British government in 1850 and there was some terrible tyranny across the world, it would come to me, or knowledge of it would come to me in the form perhaps of garbled reports or perhaps of written diplomatic reports that had taken 6 months to get across the world. These days we know fairly soon, and we can know in many cases in some detail about what's going on. So you can have people who are in the position that Tony Blair evidently thought he was in shortly after 9/11 when he made that extraordinary speech to the Labour Party conference in England when he said, you know, we're going to sort this out and we can no longer ignore what's happening elsewhere in the world. You know, we should have done something at Rwanda and so on. All these, you know, we are members one of another, which to some extent is the product of Tony Blair's own religious evangelical fervour, but is also the product simply of the modern world of communications.
It's true that we have, in a sense, harder dilemmas now, or dilemmas which we know to be harder than we had in previous times, because we know the suffering that we can't help. I mean, if not even in 1850, but perhaps even in 1910, there was the telegraph then, and there were world newspapers, but if there was an earthquake in China, or if there was some horrible outbreak of warfare in some part of the world, or a tyrant, not very much of it got through. So in a sense, the dilemmas were easier to tolerate. Now we do know a great deal, maybe not absolutely everything. For example, I don't think most of the hideous, atrocious repression that Mao and even subsequent Chinese governments perpetrated in Tibet wasn't photographed, wasn't filmed, because you couldn't get in, you weren't allowed in, you couldn't get out if you did get in. There have been some kind of things that have come out in recent Tibetan protests about Tibet. One of the great, I think, cruel acts of oppression, one of the worst semi-genocidal destructions or attempted destructions of a culture and a people in recent times. But most of it is still not widely known about it. And I would say also there is a sort of countervailing tendency, which is of so-called compassion fatigue. People now think, I've heard too much about Iraq, let's switch channels. Well, you can't switch channels if you're in Iraq. Well, you can't switch channels in a way that ends the war. You're stuck with it. Your children will be stuck with it. Their children will be stuck with it. There's that too, and an unwillingness. I mean, I often talk about the depth and the extremity of oppression in the former Soviet Union. Not that many people are really interested anymore, because it seems a long time ago, and it's very bad news, a lot of it. And after a while, it sort of gets to you in a way. So while all that you say is true, but remember, people who say we should be doing something much more than we're doing in Burma, it's a terrible situation. But what is it that we're going to do? I'm not an expert on humanitarian aid and relief, but I've heard experts say, well, if we do drop things in against the will of the Burmese government, 90% of them will be wasted. So we're going to distribute them, and the Burmese government says you can't come in, so we go in by force. And once we're in by force, do we stay there by force? How long do we stay there? Do we have another regime change? Stay there forever, 40 years? The British have been in Cyprus for over 40 years. I mean, kind of small, little, tiny kind of conflict, but you're really willing to be there for 40, 50 years? It seems to me to be, we should do absolutely the most that we can, subject to the constraints that we face, but we should not adopt poses which we can't deliver on, because then we're cheating the people we're promising aid to. Then we're saying, we'll help you. Then when we don't show up, we say, well, we do feel for you.
We feel your pain.
I mean, that happened before, as you know, when the Hungarians rose in 56. Various Western radio stations said, we're behind you. Now, we couldn't go in without risking a nuclear war. We couldn't help them militarily. There might be other ways we can help. There might be various types of protest, or in the solidarity period, various kinds of photocopies were smuggled in and things like that, and I'm not necessarily opposed to that, but using military intervention, even in the case of Tibet, about which I feel very strongly, simply isn't honour. You're up against a sovereign state which is also a nuclear power. These are kind of painful realities that if we want to do the best we can in the world, we have to face up to and then do what remains for us to do.
John Gray talking to me in front of a capacity audience at this year's Sydney Writers Festival. The show is produced by Kyla Slaven, with technical production this week by Charlie McCune. And my conversation with John Gray was recorded for the ABC by ABC Fora. Details of them on our website at abc.net.au/rn/philosopherszone, which is also where you'll find information about John Gray's books. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week with another Philosopher's Zone.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.